This is Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio, our six-part series partnering with the Aspen Ideas Festival and the Spotlight Health Conference. Each week, we bring you conversations with an exceptional mix of inspiring and provocative experts who dive into topics of global and domestic health.
Good afternoon, I'm Allison Bektesh, and this is Spotlight Health. Thanks for tuning in. Marking its fifth anniversary this summer, the Spotlight Health Conference has already become known for bringing in speakers and ideas that are several steps ahead of the curve when it comes to health and medicine. This year, one of the conference tracks is aptly named The Cutting Edge of Medicine and Science. Spotlight Health co-producer Ruth Katz explains what to expect from this focus.
What is new and exciting in terms of being worked on and maybe 2 or 3 years down the pike, our attendees will say, you know, I heard about that at Spotlight Health just a couple of years ago. Cutting edge, meaning this is the stuff that's going to really advance medicine and healthcare, and you're hopefully, the place you're going to be hearing about it for the first time is at Spotlight Health. So we will be focusing on things such as genetics, but gene therapy, gene editing. You're going to be hearing about progress that's being made in cancer treatment, particularly in immunotherapy, which holds great promise. The idea is really very science-focused, medicine-focused. That is, you know, what will help individuals and stuff that you might not have heard of yet, but you're going to hear about in the coming years from the people who are doing it themselves.
When Larry Smarr walked into Dr. Sonia Ramamoorthy's office, he could have come across as a nightmare patient.
So then the next thing I said is, you know, I've been giving tours in 3D through the inside of my abdomen for the last 4 years, and I know in great detail what you're going to encounter when you get in there surgically. Do you know?
But instead, it was a dream come true.
The fact that someone took the time to put together a PowerPoint presentation on their situation that would bring them into my clinic, certainly I had to give them my attention.
I spoke first with Dr. Smarr, an astrophysicist who turned his research inward only to discover a whole new world within. What do we know more about the human body or the entire universe?
Well, you know, I used to think that astrophysics was the most complicated science. I now understand that, in fact, our own body is more complicated than a lot of the universe. For instance, there are 100 billion stars in our galaxy. There are 100 billion to a trillion galaxies. So that's a lot of stars in the observable universe. Turns out that on planet Earth, there are about 100 million times as many microbe cells as there are stars in the observable universe.
I want to turn to your personal story. I can't pass up talking about poop on the radio, if I'm able. You started looking at the biochemistry of your own feces, keeping detailed charts of their microbial contents. Can we start with getting a little bit graphic? What was the process for making sure you could collect all of this?
Well, you know, we each produce plenty of stool sample, most of us every day. So all you need to do is put a little trap in your toilet, a little thing to hold it, and then you just scoop off some, put it in a tube, and you're done. In fact, that's what I've done now over 100 times in the last, I guess since 2012. And then those are frozen immediately. And then they're later gene sequenced to understand the details of the microbial ecology at that moment in time.
Is part of this just kind of like a compulsive way to check in on yourself? Or are you just the easiest sample to do this with?
I mean, you know, you're not saying I'm OCD. Right?
No. The scientific side of that. Yeah.
Look, I'm a scientist. Scientists are disciplined. They know what they need to do. They come up with an experimental protocol. They need to do it however many times, you know, and you do what you have to do to get the data. That's very simple. That's how I'm trained. So this was just applying the scientific methodology to my own body.
You came to a doctor and you said, hey, here's the data that's showing something's not right. And he said, well, where's the symptoms?
That's correct. The problem is, in the United States, we do not have a healthcare system. That's a complete misnomer. We have a sick care system. You only use that system when you have become manifestly sick. But the problems for particularly chronic disease start many years earlier. And if you're tracking the symptoms and you see you're beginning to move toward what, if you don't do something, will lead to a chronic disease, and you make adjustments when it's still very small, you will not end up getting that chronic disease. So that's a healthcare system where you monitor the person all along the way, not because they've got bad symptoms or they're feeling sick, but to prevent them from eventually developing a chronic disease.
Dr. Larry Smarr's story would be quite different if the hero didn't emerge in the form of Dr. Sonia Ramamurthy. Through 10 years of data collection on his microbiome, Smarr self-diagnosed his own Crohn's disease and came to Dr. Ramamurthy for a surgery to remove part of his intestine. I began my talk with her by asking about her first encounter with her well-prepared patient.
You know, he was going to need an operation from me, and when I went in to see him, he said, he was telling me what was going on. He goes, I think it's time for me to have surgery. I said, okay. And I was kind of trying to look on the computer with our electronic medical record, see what was going on. And he says, well, he goes, you got a minute? I happen to have a PowerPoint presentation on my situation. And I, what do you say to that? You're like, oh, okay. I mean, that just has never happened before. So the fact that someone took the time to put together a PowerPoint presentation on their situation that would bring them into my clinic, certainly I had to give them my attention.
Was there an equivalent of robotic assistance or computer assistance? What kind of technology were you using on as a young surgeon?
Oh my gosh. When I was a resident, everything was on a paper chart, first of all. So people have these huge files and you would never get through all of it. There was, surgery was all open. So, and you know, the saying was the bigger the incision, the better the surgeon. So you had giant incisions for patients. There was almost nothing done on the computer. We barely had the beginnings of cell phones. We were all still carrying pagers around, and it was funny. It was a time when if you were driving in your car and your pager went off, you'd have to wait till you got home, or if someone had paged you 911, you'd pull over and you'd put a dime in the telephone booth and call them and find, you know, what the problem was. But the person on the other side wasn't expecting a call back right away either. And so much has changed since then. We're all so connected. And technology has moved really fast, and there are parts of surgery that have moved along with it, and there are parts of surgery where we still need to push the envelope.
Well, yeah, what does it look like now? What do you use or rely on when you go into, it sounds like you're not completely slicing someone open these days.
No, you know, one of the big, you know, paradigm shifts that happened during my training was just the beginning of the advent of minimal invasive surgery. So instead of making these big incisions, we now are making smaller incisions on the order of a centimeter, a couple centimeters, to perform the surgery with these long instruments, laparoscopic instruments or chopsticks, however you want to look at it. But, you know, the benefit to the patient was smaller incisions, faster recovery. We were creating less trauma, less inflammation. And so some of the operations could be done. And as time has moved on, we're able to do more operations this way. And then the next paradigm shift was to a robotic platform where you no longer had the surgeon's hands on the end of those chopsticks. It was a robotic arm or a telemanipulator, and the surgeon was sitting at a console manipulating those arms. And the next wave that's coming through is really what we did with Larry's surgery, which was integrating lots of different information into that operative procedure. So integrating the imaging and integrating some of the data that was available to us preoperatively actually into our operative plan and actually using that to help visualize kind of 3D what we were doing in real time and integrating procedures that were being done simultaneously on the patient. So Dr. Sanborn, our chief of GI, who's Larry's gastroenterologist, had come into the operating room and was performing a colonoscopy at the same time I was operating on the colon, because we needed kind of that feedback loop between the two of us to accomplish the goal. And I was able to sort of see things from multiple different vantage points, from inside the colon, from the outside of the colon, from the 3D imaging that we had. It was really quite a bit of integration of information that we had not seen before with surgery.
You're in this track called the cutting edge of medicine and science. What's coming up that you have your eye on and just can't wait till it's in fruition?
Oh my gosh. Where do you begin? I think a lot of augmented reality, a lot of virtual reality, a ton of automation in medicine. I think a lot of things that will help improve our access to patients in places where they don't have great medical care, bringing that to them, being able to respond faster to people. You know, there's a delay you want to avoid, either in when patients have symptoms, them getting the access to you, or when it's an emergency, them getting access to the exact expert that they need. The ability to see things we still can't see very well, very delicate nerves. You know, it's image-guided surgery in some way. You know, there's different nanoparticles and there's fluorescent antibodies that are coming out that'll allow us to see the anatomy in a way that we hadn't been able to see it before. The simulation stuff is truly exciting. And I mean, it'll allow you to sort of practice on cases before you go to the OR. And that's a lot of what, you know, saves lives again in the airline industry, like what happened with Sully, right? I mean, he had practiced emergency landing so many times. So in the moment when it happened, you know, it was as if he had done it 3 times already and knew what to do. There was no delay for panic or any of that stuff, even though I'm sure it was there. But just like in that situation, sometimes we have seconds to save someone's life. And the more you can sort of practice on the events of you know, seeing, you know, possibility A, possibility B, possibility C, and here's what I'm going to do. You know, the more that safe the operation's going to be, the better the outcome for the patient. And I think that's ultimately what we all want.
Sonia Ramamoorthy is the chief of the Division of Colon and Rectal Surgery and vice chair of surgical quality at University of California, San Diego Health. Sonia, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Allison. I appreciate your time.
You are listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio. In this 6-part series, we take a look inside the individual tracks of the Spotlight Health Conference from the Aspen Institute in Aspen, June 21st through 24th. Today, we hear from speakers from the track The Cutting Edge of Medicine and Science. Back with more in a moment. Abhilasha Karki, like Dr. Larry Smarr, studies microbes, but that's where their similarities end. I spoke with her via Skype from Kathmandu, Nepal, and asked her what cutting-edge technology they are using to combat antimicrobial resistance due to the overprescription of antibacterial drugs.
We're not using new technologies because we haven't been able to implement the old technologies themselves. For example, electricity, it's a huge problem. So in rural hospitals, they don't have electricity, so you can't do simple things like blood cultures, which you would normally do to know what infection you have. And you know, that's diagnostics is really important because once you have proper diagnostics, that's when you can prescribe the proper antibiotic. But what happens now is because we're not able to diagnose it properly, so there's an overprescription of antibiotics because, you know, you want your patients to get well, you want to be on the safe side. So you think, oh, fever, maybe this, and you just prescribe antibiotics. So at the moment, what I work with the most is setting up solar panels in rural hospitals so that they can at least do simple blood culture, which isn't cutting edge science. But for our hospitals, for our patients, it's cutting edge at the moment.
What originally got you into the field of health and science?
So while growing up in Kathmandu, there's a lot of infectious disease, and I actually saw a lot of infectious diseases related to water in my family. And I don't know, I guess that's what started it. There was always someone sick or medicines flowing in the house most of the time. So got me very curious about what was happening. And I just used to wonder why, if you had medicine 1 year, you know, it didn't prevent you from ever having it ever again.
So we're going to talk a lot about clean water, but let's talk about what's inside water. Can you define for me what gram-negative bacteria is?
So gram-negative bacteria are basically a huge chunk of the bacteria that cause gastrointestinal problems. They're widely found in water. They're widely found in the human gut. And they're also the ones that cause most of the diseases in hospitals and humans. So gram-negatives are also the bacteria that causes a lot of typhoid that we see in Kathmandu.
And how do we usually fight gram-negative bacteria?
They're a part of the environment. They're part of your body. So you would fight it only if, you know, it started causing problems or started causing diseases. And normally they would be treated with antibiotics. So things like typhoid or pneumonia. Pneumonia, you would fight with antibiotics. So if you had a disease caused by a gram-negative bacteria, then you would be given antibiotics.
Okay. And what you're saying you saw was those antibiotics started to have less and less effect.
Yes. So it's a very scary picture. When I started to studying medicine, you know, we used to read about the possibilities of having resistance. And now there are 700,000 deaths a year because of antimicrobial resistance. And so in Kathmandu, it's a very low-income country. There's a lot of poverty. There's a huge lack of access to water. I mean, not just clean water, but, you know, we've got huge problems with water supplies in the city. And this has caused a lot of issues with sanitation and hygiene. And there's rampant spread of infectious diseases like typhoid. And, just a few months ago, it was in the news that in Pakistan, there's now a very resistant strain of the bug that causes typhoid fever, which for us is a huge concern because Kathmandu is actually known as the typhoid capital of the world because we've got so much of it. It's very endemic. Of the 10 years that I've been doing research on typhoid, you know, it used to be quite easily cured with simple antibiotics, but now we're seeing more and more cases where, you know, people aren't getting treated. They have to be hospitalized, they spend more days in hospital, get stronger antibiotics, and this is really worrisome.
Is that an education issue? Do people not know that the proliferation of antibiotics will cause some resistance? Or do they know, but they need that immediate cure and they need to get back to their lives, and so they do it anyway?
Yeah, I think it's both. There is a lack of general awareness as well as a lack of education. But then there is a population who know, but, you know, they have no other alternatives. They need to get back to work. They can't afford to miss out on a day's worth of wages.
What are your hopes? Where will your research lead and how can it help?
I think for me, one of the biggest things that I'd like to have be able to achieve is to get the hospitals a good infection control policy and to start the antimicrobial stewardship program in the hospital. So one policy that I really want to get the government's notice is to implement that not to sell antibiotics without a prescription. I don't know how successful I'll be, but we will give it a big push.
Why is that worth it for you? I mean, I think you could work in any medical institution that had tons of resources, and yet this is where you're putting your energy. Why?
You know, if you don't control it in these hospitals, there's no way you're going to control it in big, well-resourced hospitals. I mean, you know, microbes at the end of the day, they do have the last word, I think. And, you know, they'll just sneak in. So I think you need to control it before they can sneak anywhere.
Apilasha Karki is a research fellow from the University of Oxford. She joins me via Skype. Apilasha, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio, a partnership with the Aspen Ideals Festival and the Spotlight Health Conference, which celebrates its fifth year this summer. Our six-week series takes you inside the discussions and discoveries leading up to the conference. We'll be right back. Today, we are highlighting the conference track titled The Cutting Edge of Medicine and Science, which, yes, is a fascinating topic, but is it profitable? Vanessa Mason, co-founder and managing director of P2 Health Ventures, was discouraged when she got to the Bay Area after obtaining her master's degree in public health and found venture capitalists were not putting financing behind medical advances. So Mason has taken it upon herself to connect the money with the medicine.
And I just remember having this moment where I was walking around the space with all these startups that are doing these really cool, cutting-edge, innovative things. And they would say, well, what's your background? And I would say, well, I have a master's in public health. Or actually, I would say I would have an MPH. And they would go, MPH? Is that miles per hour? And it was this incredible experience of, you know, there's so much innovation happening, and I was so grateful and excited by all of that, but all of it was just really completely divorced from evidence. It was really, a lot of it was just really divorced from, you know, the tried and true practices and things that we knew that were necessary to actually have populations be healthier. And that kind of was, that was a persistent theme throughout my digital health career out in the Bay Area. I moved on to a nonprofit consulting organization where I managed an entire portfolio of solutions really targeted towards improving healthcare outcomes for vulnerable populations, and then ran into this different issue of, this is really cool, innovative work that's actually solving these core issues, but it's very undercapitalized and it's very under-resourced. Almost everything I worked on was grant-funded, and once the grant ended, then that's where the innovation stopped. And so it was this different issue of, well, now I'm finally doing what works, but now there's no way to actually do that at scale. And that's really where P2 Health came out of, that sort of coming across this problem persistently and really wanting to do something about it and wanting to see solutions out in the world that were addressing those core problems and that were really aiming to improve healthcare outcomes for everyone.
Another thing that you pull into a lot of what you do and a lot of your consulting is behavioral science. How does that fit into everything?
At the end of the day, like, if you're trying to affect social and environmental behavioral factors, you have to change people. In order to change people, you need to both know them and know what motivates them, as well as like how you can drive them to adopt or shift or abandon certain behaviors so that you can see the outcomes that you need. How do you actually change behavior? What is driving behavior? Because at the end of the day, if you can't get someone to do something, and even more importantly, I think what gets forgotten, to do it persistently, it doesn't really matter how wonderful your tech is. And like, we've seen this happen already in digital health. You know, I got here in 2012. I think the Fitbit IPO was shortly around that time, 2013 maybe. And everyone was super, super excited about wearables. And then the stats started coming out about how about 2/3 of people abandoned their Fitbits within 3 months. And so this issue, I think, of behavioral science isn't one that gets discussed. Public health folks talk about it a lot, the need to both, you know, to both affect behavior change and to sustain behavior change. And I think it's a much needed conversation that right now the healthcare industry hasn't really hasn't been concerned about, because once they kind of deal with you in that moment, they haven't really had to be responsible for that, but now they are. And so that's why I think public health tech is just extremely timely. You know, the market is shifting in a way where we have to, again, extend this time horizon. The issue of cost is really on everyone's mind, especially when it comes to prescription drug cost. And you have to think about behavior when it comes to that, and not just the behavior of patients and consumers, but the behaviors of folks within the healthcare system, and that thinking about how they prescribe, you know, how are they actually assessing folks, like how are they interacting with caregivers, like all of those are fundamentally about changing the behavior of people so that the system itself becomes more productive and produces better healthcare outcomes. And that is public health in a nutshell.
It's such a flip, because right now being unhealthy is where it's profitable. You brought up prescription medicine earlier, that the doctor gets paid when you go see them. The more you see them, then they get paid more. I mean, the sick people are what's driving the health economy right now.
It is. And everyone knows this. It's like 5% of the population is driving 50% of the cost. That's crazy. We should focus on, well, what are the issues that the 5% are having? And if we even diminish those somewhat, we're saving so much. But I think it's also like a conversation that needs to be had too. And I think an honest one that folks haven't started having is that, you know, the system functions this way because certain players are benefiting financially from the dysfunction. And we haven't really had as much of a conversation about the fact that, well, once we start fixing the dysfunction, that means we are taking away a lot of folks' profits. So how do we both navigate that, and also to the extent that we can either mitigate it or shift that in some way? You know, it's just, again, this is another people and change management issue that I think doesn't occur as much, but it's causing, it causes resistance to innovation, and it's something that has to be addressed if we're actually going to get to a place where we actually see real health outcomes improvement.
Vanessa Mason is the Managing Director of P2 Health Ventures. Vanessa, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Spotlight Health 2018, Episode 2, The Cutting Edge of Medicine and Science. Tune in next week as we look into another Spotlight Health conference track, Our Planet, Our Health. Feeling stressed? Forest bathing can help with that. Also, how recreationalists can help improve the health of the planet and themselves. And recovering after natural disasters, something we're going to have to get better and better at. That's next week. To get caught up on episodes while you wait, go online, aspenpublicradio.org. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Spotlight Health, a partnership with the Aspen Ideas Festival and the Spotlight Health Conference. Join us Tuesdays at 3:30 for conversations with featured speakers from the 2018 festival. Hear from leaders in medical research, patient care, and others on the forefront of health. You can also listen to this series online at aspenpublicradio.org. The 2018 conference runs from June 21st through 24th and features 5 program tracks: The Cutting Edge of Medicine and Science, Healthy Communities, Disrupting Health Systems, Our Planet, Our Health, and Viewpoints. Spotlight Health is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.